Hi there. Come up on the porch. We're just sitting here watching it rain and talking about Louisiana.
I'm Bruce McGee.
And I'm Steve Payne.
And this is the Louisiana Anthology Podcast, episode 471, for May 28th, 2022.
Welcome back.
Today is our happy anniversary day, 10 years for the website and 9 years for the podcast. Can you believe it?
We need to have some, you know, some like cheers going off and maybe balloons and some noisemakers right now.
Right. Get Sam Cedar a shofar for ourselves.
Yeah.
It's a shofar for people.
We should call in and say, Sam, could we have a shofar for the 10-year anniversary of our little lefty show or whatever we are.
In a few minutes, you and I are going to do what we do best, which is reminisce about what we've been up to in the anthology and the podcast and the cooking blog and all the other stuff we're up to. So we'll be looking forward to that chat. But first, this week in Louisiana history.
So this week in Louisiana history, on May 29th, 1948, the Desire streetcars stopped running. Did they just kill the lion? Is that what they did? Or
I think so, yeah. So, no more kindness of strangers. So, now for this week in New Orleans history, May 28th, 1964, Mrs. Ellis was honored as the Woman of the Year by the Women's Auxiliary of the Protestant Children's Home. So, everybody had their own particular kind of children's home and other services based on what religion they were back in those days.
Who is that Mrs. Ellis? Do you know?
I have no idea. She's just on the board of the Protestant.
Oh, okay.
Now for this week in Louisiana.
So this week in Louisiana, we are looking at the town of Vermilionville. Is this a festival we're
talking? I think
it's just
a town.
Okay. So it says head over to Vermilionville, a living history museum and a folklife park along the Bayou Vermilion, to learn about the culture of Native Americans, African Americans, Creoles, and people of African descent in the area from the time period 1765 to 1890. See how these groups interacted and how their influence played a part in what made the Lafayette of today. Dine at La Cuisine de Maman in a truly unique setting.
Which is Miles Cuisine, if I translated that correctly.
Well, and this is probably, I guess it is part of the Lafayette metro area.
I guess so. I don't
know.
Yeah. Vermilionville. It depends on whether you're saying it like the French or the English. So, yeah.
Red, right?
Right.
It's a shade of red. Vermilion is a shade of red, isn't it?
Oh, right. So, going down, they're waiting for you there. Now for this week's postcard from Louisiana, I listened to a jazz trio play at the Frenchman Hotel on Frenchman Street in New Orleans.
Thank you.
now on to our anniversary episode.
I'm Bruce McGee.
And I'm Steve Payne.
And it's just us for now. We're waiting to see if Lamar may be able to join us in a bit. But this is our anniversary episode. So pop some of the champagne. It's 10 years for the Louisiana Anthology and 9 years for the podcast, which is both kind of amazing to me.
Yeah, it's still, you know, that we've lasted this long and that we're being carried on what we think now about 18 different platforms. So it's pretty phenomenal that a literary and cultural podcast would, you know, be getting this much, I guess you'd say, coverage. So.
And we've up, what was the word I was going to use? We're trying to improve our project. We set up a separate website that's much shorter and easier to remember. If you type in Louisiana Anthology, that'll take you to our site, but also Louisiana-anthology.org. So we have our own independent website now. Whenever I retire, which is getting closer, let's, I'm 64. My website at Tech will be taken down. They only keep them for current faculty. So we want this to last beyond my exit from there. And also, we've always thought that the URL we had before was super long. And so this one's just Louisiana-anthology.org. And it's got all of our stuff on it.
It's kind of a clone of the other site, isn't it?
It was originally a clone. I've been updating the new site, but not the old one. So all the old stuff is still at the old site, but I haven't been updating it. At some point, we'll need to set up a forwarding thing on the old website so that it pops people over to the new one automatically. Because at some point, when I do retire, that will be gone anyway. So by then, we hope that all the links will be refreshed to go to our new site.
Migrating or whatever to the other site?
Yes, migrating. Perfect term for it. That's right.
So, yeah. And we're not far. We were talking about this before we went to Mike today, but we're not far from our 500th episode.
That's true. Let's see. Where are we in our episode?
Did you say we had 478 that were already taped?
400. Well, more than that, but up online, we've got 470. So this will be 471.
Okay.
And then 472. And you think one a week doesn't seem like a lot until you've done it for 9 years, and then all of a sudden you're closing in on your 500th episode. I guess that makes sense of 52 episodes a year.
Right.
Counting the in-between, like some of our breaking political podcasts are numbered like 320A.
Right.
Because I didn't want to mess up. We had all of our numbering figured out for months, and I didn't want to have to renumber everything. So we would just put it kind of in between. So really, we might be at 500 already, because sometimes in a hot political season, every week we'll have a Wednesday, special Wednesday episode. Now, we've had some pretty good accomplishments in the anthology over the last year. I guess our biggest one, biggest new edition, well, new to us because it's a very old book, Lyle Saxon's Gumbo Ya-Ya, which is a famous book. And it was written by WPA writers. People know about the buildings, right? WPA hired people to lay bricks and be a carpenter. And one of my grandfathers was a carpenter, the other laid bricks. That's how I know that. But they also hired intellectuals who were out of work. And
writers and also dramatists. There was a federal theater project too.
and stuff that doesn't even look, you know, like you look back, if you look at the Louisiana digital archives, a lot of the stuff in there was where the WPA took an old newspaper clipping that was getting, you know, disintegrating. They just retyped it on a manual typewriter, Courier font. You know, you can recognize it. And they put in a file for, what, 60, 70 years. And then one day somebody took it out and put it on the internet. And it's just amazing material that they preserved. And they were kind of laying the groundwork for the later digital era. If you've ever tried to read an old newspaper online, you know how wretched that is. And these are a lot better to read.
There's some pretty amazing stuff
yeah.
that those writers and, you know, dramatist type projects did. There's one thing I just found out about last year, maybe, when we were, you and I were first looking at some of the Federal Writers Project stuff, and I was looking around online and found these theater projects. They were traveling from state to state and staging plays that they did, and our listeners will recognize this name when I mention it, but Orson Welles did an all-black staging of Macbeth.
Oh, my goodness. I bet that
was and, bad. Yeah, and it was, I think, I don't know if they filmed all of it or maybe just a portion of it, but I saw some clips, and it was, if I'm not mistaken, it was thought lost for many, many years, because this is, you know, around, we'll say around 1935, 36, but it was before he went on air with the Mercury Theater of the Air that did the War of the Worlds broadcast. Yeah, it was before that, but it was still, he was a young guy on the way up in the theatrical world. And so they did this, you know, production of Macbeth that was pretty revolutionary for that time. Like I said, it was, again, the film of it was so rare, as I think it was thought lost, and it has been found, and they've got at least some of it is preserved. It may be just a sequence of it or just a segment of it, but I know that there's a little bit of it preserved, so you get to see the actors actually going on stage and doing their work.
Okay, so here's some of the table of contents of Gumbo Yaya. And it is a mixed bag. Apparently, Saxon had a team of people who went around New Orleans, but also other parts of Louisiana, make it into the book, and collect, what you call them, folklore from the period. So we've got kings, baby dolls, Zulus, and queens is chapter one, which, you know, are some Mardi Gras things. Street criers is chapter two. So people just walking around, you know, selling stuff off the back of wagons. Chapter three, the Irish Channel. How about that? Chapter four, the Axeman's Jazz. I don't think we've ever had an episode on the Axeman, have we?
Not that I recall. He's the famous, or infamous, I guess, serial murderer.
Right.
Is it early 20th century New Orleans?
Okay. Yeah. He wrote a letter to the Times-Picayune, which we have in our collection, that tells people that he's going to be out hunting with his axe, and if he hears jazz playing inside the house, he'll keep going. But if it's something else, he's going to come in and kill you, so you better play jazz. He sold a lot of records.
Boy.
And it just goes on and on.
And the killings or the perpetrator, the identity of the perpetrator was never discovered. Or, you know,
right.
The murders were never solved. It was just a lot of, you know, the usual senseless killing.
And the last chapter is one you probably will recognize. Who killed the chief?
Yeah.
You know, the police chief.
Dave Hennessy. Yeah.
Hennessy, yeah.
Oh.
So he's got a chapter on that. But a lot of it, you know, like ghosts. What are some of the folklore about ghosts? And then they have appendices, a bunch of superstitions. Here's the first one, asthma. A charm or fetish to cure asthma is made up of some of the victim's hair tied up in red flannel, which has been placed in a crack in the floor. So I would say that's voodoo, right?
Mm-hmm. Sounds like it.
Yeah. Backache. Oh, here we go. Both of us have backaches. Make 9 knots in a tarred rope and tie it around your waist. That's from Ms. A. Anthony, 718 and a half Orleans Street. Bee sting. Apply 7 different kinds of leaves to a bee sting. Well, back when I was growing up, they would just apply some chewing tobacco.
Yeah.
It kind of worked. You know, some of this stuff probably...
Maybe the nicotine may counteract the, you know, the sting. It's just like the I was telling you about the toothpaste that you could get a dab of that, enough to fit on the end of your ring finger and apply that to, like, the bee sting. I've had that from a yellow jacket sting, and they stuck it up in my crown, and, you know, top of my head.
Right.
And it stopped the sting pretty quickly. It was just toothpaste, and my aunt knew to do that. Yeah, so I've heard.
That toothpaste does kind of have a, I don't know if it's an anesthetic or what is.
Yeah, menthol and peppermint, all those are natural anesthetics.
Okay.
So it could be that, or it could be just actually counteracting it chemically. Who knows?
Right. Well, here for your bladder problems, you can feed roasted rat to a bedwetter. This is from Vance Balthazar from Isle Breville. Here's another fried rat one from Nero Street. But this one I like. Feed parched pumpkin seeds with salt for bedwetting. I could go with that one. I'm not eating a rat. To prevent blindness, you wear a charm, you pierce your ears, and wear earrings. Medicine, infusion of parsley roots with a pinch of alum. There we go. I can get into that. Or poor or bad blood, Jack Vine tea is the best blood purifier you can get. We always made tea out of it when we would be in the swamps. So, or a handful of gum moss, thimbleful of anise seeds, handful of corn shucks, rainwater, steep and take every morning. So, yeah. Anyway, it just goes on and on. This is fascinating stuff. And it's a, 600-page book. It took us how long to get this done? Hold on.
It was months and months, wasn't it?
Oh, years. We started working on this in 2014.
Oh, wow.
And finally put it on the website in 2021. How many groups? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18 groups worked on this over that several-year period. I guess the last group that worked on it was in spring of 2020, and then I went through the whole book, inserting the pictures and formatting it. It took forever, but it's a major, you know, this is one book that we've added to our project. And our project has, you know, I don't know how many hundreds of these, over a couple of hundred authors anyway.
Well, it's like the thing that I did solo when I found it, the Liberty in Louisiana, and added those notes to it and then tried to decipher the text. And, I mean, it was, I'm telling you, talk about, as the saying goes, tough sledding. That was some tough sledding. I mean, it really was.
Oh, my goodness.
Because
yeah.
I was doing it solo and with my bad back, and I'm nearsighted, so I'm squinting. Even with the text blown up, I'm squinting at the screen. And you know as well as I do, a lot of the text, it was the original text that had first been microfilmed, then they digitized the whole shooting match. And so it was degraded. You know, the text was degraded.
An update on that becoming available in print.
What's that?
I said, why don't you give our listeners an update on that becoming available in print? Because without your expertise, this would have never happened, the Liberty in Louisiana.
Well, you know, you got in touch with the woman at UL Press, right?
But go back a little. How did you find this?
Oh, I had found a stray reference to the thing in a book on, it wasn't that book on the Golden Age of New Orleans drama. It was some other book. But it was a collection of anthologized, it was essays is what it was, you know, essays about Southern literature and Southern drama. And
when
the guy had
the one, like, article that's been written on it.
Yeah, I found that after the fact. That was after the fact. But the first thing was just a stray reference to it. And I said, oh, I've never heard of this thing. Then I started looking around online, and I found more references to it. And I found, as you said, the one article. Well, it was one article at the time. Since then, there have been a number of articles, including one by our friend Vernon Palmer at Tulane. There have been several articles written about the thing, taking different angles of the text. I mean, he was looking at the, you know, the use of the Spanish code at the time.
Was the woman who had performed the play up in Missouri. What was
right.
her name?
Mary Burrell, is that
yes.
right? And she only slightly updated the text.
Right. I was about updated it a little bit.
And but yeah, I mean, I found it, and then I went to the of all places, the local library. Didn't even have to go to Tech or Grambling to do an interlibrary loan. I went to the Lincoln Parish Library and asked, you know, I had found it was available, albeit, again, as we found, it's a digitized copy. They said they could get it if I didn't mind getting it that way as digitized a file. I said, no, absolutely not. If you can send it as a PDF, do it. They did. Within about a week, maybe a little bit less, we had a copy of it. But it was degraded. I mean, because
oh my goodness.
Third or fourth generation removed from the original. So we had to do a lot of deciphering the text to try to kind of put it back together, because there were places where the text was faded or it looked as if words had dropped out of the text. So we had to kind of figure things out.
It was, something I never thought I would use in real life, textual criticism, which is, taking old manuscripts and trying to fill in the blank spots, and what is the text? Before you can do anything else in studying a text, you have to figure out what is the text. And it's a big problem with the Bible. It's a problem with Shakespeare. And this is the only surviving copy of this.
Right. It's the second edition. As the first page of the digitized version says, right there on the title page, it's the second edition. So the first
right.
first edition evidently is no longer extant, as far as we can tell.
We haven't been able to track it down. So you did an excellent job of sleuthing, and suddenly something that has been out of circulation for 200 years is back in circulation and can have a much wider circulation than it ever did in the first run.
Well, and it's a landmark in Louisiana drama. I mean,
yeah.
at least English-speaking drama, because I think there had been some other things performed in New Orleans, albeit in French. This is the first drama in English to be performed in Louisiana, or well, not in Louisiana, but to be written about Louisiana. We don't know
and
yet.
As far as we know, it's the first thing written about Louisiana in any language as a play.
Right.
Because the Festival of the New Corn was written 10 years later. It's kind of the first to market.
Well, and, who knows? Again, we might, here's a weird bit of trivia. There was that early Louisiana English-speaking newspaper, The Union, which is also the name of the first African-American-owned newspaper in Louisiana, La Union.
Wasn't there
a great irony. They're both
well,
called The Union. Huh?
Wasn't there a Monitor newspaper as well, The Monitor?
May have been. The guy that founded that, and I sent you a text about that the other day, and his name escapes me, but the guy that founded that paper was traveling around the South setting up papers. He set up another one up in Kentucky at one point, too. So eventually it was kind of natural that Louisiana being the westernmost American territory at that time, he travels into Louisiana and sets up an English-speaking newspaper.
Right. So we have a lot of old stuff on our website. We try to include some new stuff, too. Last week we interviewed Simmons. What was her first name?
Stacy. Yeah,
Stacy Simmons, who wrote a very impassioned Facebook post about her experience as working at an abortion clinic back in the early '80s in New Orleans, and so we got permission from her and. We're able to include that in our website, which makes it, stuff on Facebook, it may hang around, but it kind of scrolls down and people stop being able to find it. And if it's on our website, hopefully they'll be able to find it. And so this is something that was written a couple of weeks ago and is already on our website. That's the kind of thing you can do when you have the kind of website we have. And if it, so many of our texts are so degraded that they take a really long time to bring them to the website. But something like that that's typed up already, you can just copy and paste. It's pretty straightforward.
Well, and like you said, I mean, something like a website or an electronic, you know, any kind of electronic document like this or set of documents is able to be expanded almost, I guess you'd say ad infinitum. You can't do that with a print book. You can't do that with a magazine or any kind of print text. In other words, once the thing is printed, it's finite, right? It's just
right.
It's set in stone as, you know, some book about, or a book dealing with Louisiana literature, you know, like Confederacy of Dunces or Ernest Gaines, you know, Gathering of Old Men or whatever. I mean, it is set in stone, whereas something like this, a collection that's electronic, you can add to it in perpetuity. I'll put it that way.
Yeah, there's no upper limit.
No.
We are almost at 9 million words. I'm hoping that I've been working on finalizing it. It's taking forever. But let's see. Finishing folder. Coleman, Historical Sketchbook of New Orleans. And it says sketchbook. How long is this one? It's 366 pages, so it's not as long as Gumbo Yaya, but it's long enough, and it's taken quite a bit of finalizing, like proofreading, formatting, but hopefully it's coming in the next year. And once again, he goes through a lot of different things over the decades in New Orleans, and puts his own spin on it. So I think people find it very fascinating. So, yeah, there's always something coming down the pike.
Yeah, this kind of goes back to one of our first fears with the project. You know, we'll run out of people to interview, but also we'll run out of text to include. And what we found
right.
is quite the opposite. You know, there
yeah.
seems to be no... Well, there seems to be no end in sight of guests or of text, but what was bigger and I think more critical for us to realize was the fact that we're dealing with a living culture, a living literary culture. It's not a bunch of artifacts or relics like reading something, you know, you and I both coming out of biblical studies. This is not like reading something in Coptic, you know, where that's not even really, I guess, used for anything but maybe a liturgical language anymore. But now you've got a living literary culture. People are still writing about Louisiana. Louisianans are still writing about Louisiana as well. So there doesn't seem to be any end in sight, which is good for us, but also hopefully good for
the new French and Spanish stuff being written. We haven't found the Spanish stuff, but we've got a lot of Spanish, you know, Hispanic people, Spanish speakers.
Yeah.
Stuff. Somewhere out there, there's some stuff, but we do have some modern blog posts in French that we've gotten permission to cross-post on our website.
Yeah, it's pretty incredible, the stuff that we've been able to come up with, but also the stuff that we are finding. You know, before you and I went to Mike this afternoon, I mean, I was telling you about a woman that, you know, could be a potential guest for us. I hadn't even contacted yet. So we're always finding new people that I think would be hopefully a good fit for us, but also it would be interesting for our listeners, you know, to learn
right.
about. And that's what we're, you know, one of the goals too is to keep the show fresh, you know, and
mm-hmm.
interview people who have something interesting to say, or they've written something that's particularly compelling or really kind of captures the essence of Louisiana and the people of Louisiana.
As we look back at this last year of our podcast, we've had some really great guests. We had a few weeks ago our friend Wesley Harris. I've literally known Wesley since 1972.
Wow.
Oh, my goodness. It's, 50 years?
Wow.
And he has, you know, he was a law enforcement for many, many years, detective and stuff like that, which is kind of, you know, sifting through evidence and putting it together. And he also is trained as a historian. He's done a lot of graduate work at Louisiana Tech and has made himself into kind of the Ruston area historian.
Yeah, he does a lot of North Louisiana history. I think, isn't mm-hmm. he the in-house historian up in Claiborne Parish? I want to say he is.
Oh, Yeah.
Up in at the library, I think.
He's retired two or three times. He keeps going back to work doing
like
stuff.
Like the old song, man, back in the saddle again.
Well, you know, old guys need something to do. I'm becoming more and more convinced of that. I've known too many friends of mine, slightly older, who would finish working and just kind of go home and sit. And that's not good. They either have...
And then they have a heart attack right after the fact, you know?
Yeah. We had two or three colleagues, Stephen, back in the day. Retired and 3 months later, they were dead.
Yeah, you remember Dennis Miner, one of the really good, very first-rate 19th-century American lit scholar and technical writing scholar, and he retired. He was dead within, what, two or three months?
He kind of created the technical writing program at Louisiana Tech, so very important guy. He wasn't that old, either, when he retired. Like one of these 80-year-old guys. From my perspective today, he was quite young and passed away quickly. So, yeah, we like to keep busy. And you and I have a hobby here that will keep us busy.
Well,
I like that.
We can do this into our 90s. I mean, I say that without sounding morbid, but I think about this great political philosopher and scholar, Sheldon Wolin. He was writing until his 90s, which is, my mother's going to turn. If she makes it, we'll turn 102 in October.
If you're a boxer or a football player, you do your best work in your 20s. But if you're a scholar and, things break right for you, keep your health.
Oh, well, that was Wolin. He did, I don't know, I think it was the original edition and the update of his book, Democracy, Inc., in his 90s. I know the update for sure came in his 90s. Yeah, it was just phenomenal. I've read the thing twice. And he was around 94, 95 years old, I think, when he did that update. But he was well into his 90s when he was, he's still writing, which is phenomenal.
Got to keep your mind working. So we talked to Wes. So we also, looking back, talked to Jari Honora, who is a New Orleans-based genealogist. And he's a professional genealogist, but he started... It was, what, like 14, maybe younger?
Yeah.
Has just been instrumental in helping people put together, a connection with their past, because especially people leaving New Orleans would often do so in order to pass as white so that they wouldn't have the stigma of blackness holding them back. And that meant oftentimes cutting yourself off from your roots, and then these descendants, grandchildren, great-grandchildren, there's just kind of a question mark as to where they came from. And he helps fill in the blanks.
There is a, we deal with this in literature a lot. That's one of the most primal questions that we can ask in literature that really only literature and maybe religion and art can answer the question too, but it's who am I, right?
Right.
Who am I? Who are my people, so to speak? And that's a primal kind of a question that comes up across cultures or across the world. It's not just, in Louisiana or the South or the United States. That's a very primal question to ask.
Right. It is.
And so if you are, from one of these communities where you've, basically changed your identity, which is what passing involves, changing your identity, changing your people, et cetera, or at least attempting to do so. And then, or if you, let's say your parents did it and so you have no conception of who you are, it is, again, it's like having a piece of your own self being cut out of yourself or carved out. So reestablishing or maybe, reintegrating that piece with the bigger self is critical, I think, for people.
We also have... We interviewed Emily Toth, who is a world-class, maybe the world-class, Kate Chopin scholar. Didn't she write some biography?
Yeah.
Maybe two.
Was she one of your professors at LSU? Or?
No. We've talked about this before, that I went to school to get away from it, and so I didn't study a lick of it.
And so 10 years ago, you and I had to start, you know, a lot of it I learned from you because you had been thinking about this stuff and, you know, reading up on our culture. But just the process of doing this has been my education. So unfortunately, I did not have her as a teacher.
I had done it, but I go back to when we were going through tech, you know, you were going through in the late 70s, I was going through in the early to mid 80s, and we, a lot of people in history, and you were one of them, took that Louisiana history class. I never
did. Oh, I loved it, yeah.
I wish I had taken it now with Dr. Peoples.
Oh, my goodness.
A great historian, you know.
It was a packed-out class. I think it was overfilled. Which is very unusual for upper-level history class, let me tell you. But every Louisiana teacher had to take that class.
Right.
Part of their curriculum. So I thought, yeah, it's one of the things we did right, making our young teachers in training learn about their own history and getting Morgan Peoples to do the job of teaching. He was just so awesome.
Well, and like you said, you know, who would think, it's rather like our project, but who would think that many people would sign up for a Louisiana history class? Because all the social studies ed majors had to have it, all the English ed majors had to have it. I guess, I don't know about math ed majors, but those, you know, people in those other two areas are sure had to have that class.
Yeah, if you were going to teach the humanities, at the very least, I had to take it. So it was a good class. So anyway.
And you look at, too, again, it being an upper division course, who would think that so many people would be interested, but they wanted to know about the history of their own state. They were curious, you know.
Right.
So I think that's a good thing. And bringing somebody on like Emily that has that kind of insight, like Dr. Peoples had, I think it's really valuable where you've got kind of a permanent record, or as permanent as can be, at least as reasonably possible, with, you know, a recording of their insights. I mean, you know, I wish we could have done that with Dr. Peoples when he was still around.
Oh yeah, you know, it's like planting a tree, Stephen. The best time to plant a tree is 50 years ago. The second best time to plant a tree is today. And so 9 years ago, we started doing these recordings, and one of our first interviews was with our old friend Wiley Hilburn, who had taught journalism at Tech, and he was you know, he has a massive amount of material that he's published, but very seldom did he give an interview, and our interview turned out to be one of the few he gave, and passed away maybe, what, 6 months later?
Yeah, it could very well be the final interview he gave. Because, as you said, he didn't give that many. He wanted, and his daughter said this too, he did, and he said it as well, that he did not want to be the focus of the news. He wanted to go and report the news, report it.
He had a
very
great
likely about his final interview.
Great writing voice. If he was in a story, it was as the reporter, and you got to see his reaction. He didn't generally go, you know, just focus on himself. It was like, carry him with the deputy. What are we going to do? You know, and kind of a wry humorist, I liked his style. But, you know, there have been several of our interviews over the last 9 years that, you know, at some point after the interview, they've passed away. And so you want to get these interviews when you can, and not, you know, not wait.
Yeah, I mean, I can think of three or four of our guests that have passed away. You know, Christina Bella passed away. The guy that did the book on Highway 80, that I wish we could, you know, track down his heirs, because he has died and his wife has died. And I don't know if he's got children. I want to say he does, but that likely will not be published at this point. And you and I saw the manuscript. It was a big, big, thick binder, a thick, thick binder that we saw at their house over in Monroe. Wesley Harris has talked about doing a Highway 80 book. You know, I hope he'll follow through on it, because that would be the next thing to what the other fellow did. I think his name was Lee something or other. I'd have to go back and look at our show notes.
But Lee, course, it'll come in about, you know, right after we get off the phone.
Yeah, exactly. But he's passed away. And then, of course, as you said, Wiley's died.
But that was one of our early interviews. We drove to his house in the rain, I remember.
Yeah.
I think it was raining. It might not have been.
Oh, yo, we drove over to West Monroe. That was when we went to talk with that poet over there.
That's right. That's right.
Because the weather was really bad most of the, you know, drive over. And it kind of cleared off a little bit at the end, you know, as we were leaving his house.
That's right. Now I remember.
But yeah, I think we've had one or two others who have died. So, I mean, it's, you don't know. We talk about the literary commonplace about the fragility of life, but it's true. I mean, we've seen it on our show, people dying on us.
All right.
Unfortunately.
So another thing we've done is sometimes we'll have crossover stuff. Like sometimes the things in the podcast are kind of separate from the stuff on the website, but that's not always the case. We had Mary Niall Mitchell last Paul, who researched into these pictures that I saw on the internet, and it was a picture of white kids who had been held as slaves in New Orleans, and the Union Army freed them, and then they took pictures of them and took them to New York and put them up on stage to try to raise money to fund schools in New Orleans. To educate the former slaves. So, you know, it's kind of an interesting story. But you see these pictures from time to time without any context. So we got a woman who had done research into it. We also found the original articles, I believe, in Harper's Magazine that had the pictures and published them for the first time. Yeah, Harper's Magazine, Slave Children and White and Colored Slaves. And so we have the full articles and all the pictures they took, which are a number of them. But it was, you know, white supremacy was at the heart of slavery. And yet, after a few generations of Southern owners having their way with their slave women, you had some very light-skinned children who were still kept as slaves.
Yeah, so, yeah.
What is white? What is black? Well, these kids look, you know, they look white, and yet they were by definition black and therefore slaves. And so we have material on our website, but we also have the interview with Mary to kind of explain what's going on here.
Yeah, you know, that whole system of white supremacy, which, you know, survives in, you know, not particularly altered form today. That whole system, not only, you know, you've got black and brown people being exploited, Native people being exploited, exploits women. Of every ethnicity and race. It exploits poor whites, as Dr. William Barber has always wanted to point out in the Poor People's Campaign. You know, you have more poor whites in this country than there are any other single group in the country. It's just that there's higher percentages of African Americans and some other groups that are in poverty. But that whole system of white supremacy is built upon exploitation, right? What we talked about, it's built on violence too.
And they don't realize they're complicit in their own subjugation. Like,
yeah,
there was a semi-document in West Monroe. I can't remember the name of it. Like the people who were in it were not professional actors. They were local people. And just the really poorest white people that you could find in Louisiana. That's pretty far down there, you know. And yet they're forming a militia and, you know, talking about how terrible Obama is because it was from that era.
Yeah,
and of course, you know, Obama wasn't any great shakes for any poor person as far as that goes. So, you know, we Democrats have to do a better job of offering people material benefits for their lives if we want them to vote for us. Otherwise,
yeah.
They'll vote for the guy that tells them, yeah, it's okay to hate your neighbor, and it's their fault you're so poor.
When you know, the material benefits include such things as increasing the minimum wage, to not just to $15 an hour, but to a livable or so-called living wage or fair wage, but also, you know, to make housing more affordable.
We need public housing. We haven't built public housing in decades. The private housing stock is being bought up by these companies that then hike the rent. They don't want to sell or have rent houses. You're paying more for rent than you would for a mortgage.
Well, and then also, you know, universal health care. That's another thing. You know, we need a true universal health care program. We need good quality public schools, good rigorous public schools. And get rid of all this business about school choice, which has just been an affront to people like you and me that came out of public schools.
Right. Looking back a little over our list of interviews from the last year, we had Harvey Kate on a Zoom interview. And he, of course, likes to talk about Roosevelt. And we, of course, like to talk about the Long Brothers. Yeah, Roosevelt was all right. But you're a real progressive. How about Huey Long, the guy that built the school you went to? We talked to him. I wouldn't call it a debate, really. It's like, make me be more progressive. Fine, you know.
And that was a whole culture that came out of Winfield, you know, and Win Parish. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was the, at one time, that was probably the most radical parish in Louisiana, particularly in the time after the Civil War. Even before the Civil War, most people that lived there said, you know, this is not our fight. You know, this is a rich man's war. They recognized the class nature of the Civil War. It wasn't just racist, you know, with a bunch of people trying to prop up slavery. Your heritage be damned. It was about propping up slavery, but it was also about propping up the white elites.
Yeah, and they were not them.
Yeah.
And they had a socialist newspaper when he was growing up.
I think his father was a socialist, you know, his either father or grandfather. I mean, there was a strong socialist presence in Lynn Parish.
There was.
So this is coming out, you know, you think about that industry down there, what becomes the big industry within a short time, if it wasn't already down there, was timber. And my granddad did that for a living and could very well have been buying, you know, cutting down or later or buying later, I should say, timber out of Wynn Parish for a company that he worked for. He was one of their buyers. He'd go out and scout that and tell you, you know, how many board feet it would likely produce and also what it would cost and, you know, what people would pay for it, et cetera. But he did that as a young, you know, as a teenager and young man. It's backbreaking work and it's dangerous work. Well, that kind of work like that, the workers in that kind of industry are going to be primed for something like socialism or social democracy because they're exploited.
And unions, just for safety. My dad's best friend growing up was killed in a log accident when they were still kids, you know. And he remembered that his whole life, you know, that my friend died. And how would you know, it's not an easy thing to get over.
A tree falls on you or you get cut in two with a saw. I mean, I'm sure my granddad saw people losing limbs and God knows what, probably losing their lives.
Well, you know how those log trucks are with the poles and the chains, but one of them breaks, and that's what happened to his buddy. The chains broke and the logs rolled off onto it. So, another thing we are trying to bring forward are teaching aids so that we can get more Louisiana literature into the Louisiana classroom, because that's been a big gap over the years. And so far we have a really good set of lesson plans for All the King's Men by Robert Penn Warren. I'd say it's our most developed set of lessons. One of my students had been an English teacher for many years, and she had already been working on this. So she was willing to share her work with us, but then she led a group in expanding her material. And All the King's Men, by the way, is Robert Penn Warren's take on Huey Long. and he was kind of a patrician himself, and so it's not all that necessarily positive a take, but it's an important book. It won a Pulitzer, and the movie made from it won an Oscar. And I actually kind of like the movie that Sean Penn made back in 2005. So they brought a lot more of Huey into it, and I thought, you know, made it more clear that what they were really opposed to was progressivism, not they don't care about corruption.
Well, and if they really had, you know, to show you how bad things were, if their governance was so great, then why were, you know, again, why was there still Jim Crow in Louisiana? But also, again, why was there a class structure keeping the poor whites, like my grandmother's, some of her siblings over in the Delta, keeping them living in a cotton shack, a literal repurposed cotton shack, you know, sharecropping, farming and all that kind of business. If they were so great, then why didn't they do something about that? Or, you know, our life was so great under those people, I should say, under their governance, under those Bourbons, as they were called. You know, they wrecked the state.
Right.
They held people back, and knowingly held people back. And then you get somebody like a Mrs. Hodding Carter come along and try to defend that kind of stuff.
This is another point that I meant to make and had forgotten until just now. We found two matching articles, the one by Hodding Carter Jr. and one by that fiery fundamentalist preacher. Who was that?
That Gerald Smith. Gerald Smith. Yeah.
Yeah. He was later to become a kind of a fascist. But
yeah, he was an open fascist, absolutely.
Yeah. But as long as Huey was alive, he was a real, you know, ring. He would help whip up the crowd at Huey Long stuff. And so it shows how he can move from one to the other, like people that moved from Bernie to Trump. And you say, how can they do it? They're both outside.
They're opposite sides of the same coin, too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've mentioned that story many times, being in the divinity school and seeing, you know, some wannabe lefties up there, and really they were just garden variety liberals, but they were just as divorced from reality as these fundamentalists are, you know. And I pulled out a quarter and was showing that to somebody. I said, you're no different from this quarter, you know, the obverse and the reverse of the head and tail of that quarter.
Right.
It's still the same quarter, but it's, you know, it flips the thing. But their temperament is very similar. You know, they're always applying a litmus test to people. They're trying to divide people on trivialities, not on consequentialities, so to speak.
Right.
I mean, consequentials like justice, like equality, like freedom, et cetera. They will flip from a Bernie to a Trump. Especially if they're desperate, you know, the climate is such that people are desperate. That's why they flip like that.
Right. Well, you know, extreme times, people start looking for more extreme solutions.
Yeah.
Our solutions have ranged from Barack Obama to Mitt Romney. Oh, God help us all.
That was like a choice between autocracy and oligarchy. I mean, that's some choice.
Yeah, they're both, you know, neoliberal shills when it comes to economics, and their economics will not get much better as long as we don't have somebody that's like a Bernie willing to question, or a Huey Long, or an Earl Long, is willing to, you know, make some more fundamental changes.
Well, and you see those problems writ large right here in this state. These are not new problems. These are generational problems that go back, you know, for decades in the state. You'll have a pretty tiny class of elites in Louisiana, mostly centered in places like Baton Rouge and New Orleans, but a few up here in North Louisiana and around Shreveport and Monroe. And then you have, a kind of a weak middle class, and you have a large underclass. And so we're living, you know, we live this reality right here in the state all the time. We live it. Have I lost you there?
Sorry. Man, I had a great story. I said, you know, that's where this nostalgia for the 50s comes from. Trump can tie into it, but his lesson from the 50s is different. It's not 90% marginal tax rate. It's keep black people and women in their place. You know, there's an aristocracy of labor. We're going to put the white people up on top where they belong. You know, that was kind of what was wrong with the 50s, you know?
Mm-hmm. It was this. What do they call it? But it's in general, that whole idea is that myth of a golden age. You know, back when things were great. Well, but they were great for just a certain segment of the populace, not for everybody.
Did you say our senator, the so-called doctor? What's his name?
Oh, Cassidy.
Cassidy, yes. he was up there blabbing on TV about something and. Health-related, and abortion. The person asking, well, what about Louisiana's mortality rate among pregnant women? It's the highest in the country, way higher than the next highest, which is, I think, Alabama, and 14 higher times higher than California, which has 4 deaths per 100,000, and what's 14 times 4? I think it's like 58. It's just ridiculous. And he said, well, if you correct the population, we have a lot of black people in Louisiana, more than most other states. If you correct for that, then we don't have that high a rate. So, you know, in other words, it's not a problem because it's black women who are dying complications, which is super racist, right?
But yeah, again, and he's part of the elite. I mean, he is openly admitting and doesn't even have the sophistication, much less the heart, to admit that the system is fundamentally unjust and unequal, right? I mean, that's what he's just admitted.
Right.
That's what he's just admitted. You know, it is both racist and classist. You know, we're dealing with medical racism here, medical classism.
Makes the problem better, actually makes the problem worse. He's saying Louisiana has a racist medical care system. And so that makes it all right. That's just silly. Oh, and we never got quite the story I was going to talk about. Now, every year we try to do conferences. Our favorite one is the Louisiana Studies Conference. And last year, the theme was heroes and villains, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we had 2 takes on Huey Long, I think again by Harper's. Harper's has some interesting stuff. Let me make sure of that.
They go back, don't they go back to the Civil War? I think they maybe even before the Civil War. It's an old magazine.
Todd and Carter Jr., Huey Long, Boogeyman. No, it was the New Republic. I'm sorry.
Okay.
And then that Smith, Reverend Smith, wrote the opposite thing. You know, Huey Long is a Superman, which, given that he became a Nazi, is where our friends are as problematic as our enemies sometimes. But anyway. Smith mentions one of the great things that Huey did was putting a lot of people on the voter rolls. And we know that Huey Long put both black people and white people who were poor on the voting rolls because they would vote for him, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then Carter's writing his list of horrors that Huey Long did, and Huey Long put a lot of people on the voting rolls. And these aren't our sort of people that will, you know, vote the way we want them to and understand the true needs of the state. You know, it was this whole paternalism.
Yeah, yeah.
We're going to have an aristocracy and tell you, you know, what's good for you. But once again,
that's also William F. Buckley, you know, many years later. he said that explicitly. He didn't want poor whites voting. I mean, that is naked classism. That is just flagrant classism.
and amazingly out of step with where the Republicans are today.
Yeah, they've come around, haven't they?
That's their base now. So anyway, here's another tie-in between what's on our website, what's on our in our podcast, and what we're doing out in the public, because we had 15 minutes to elaborate about our thesis at the conference, but we've got a podcast. So the day before the conference, you and I talked for, what, an hour and a half about those two articles and how they related to Huey Long. So
Right.
The people at the conference got the light version, but you folks who are listeners can go back and get the full deal. All of the thinking that went into our you know, because there's a lot you have to, mostly for a conference, you're just trying to cut. You know, there's so much material there. You're just chopping away at it.
It's heavily expurgated, as they say.
Oh, my goodness. But when we do a podcast, we can elaborate as much as we want to.
Because we're racing the clock when we do a conference, you know, because it is programmed. I mean, the thing is programmed, and each person, at least in theory, gets an allotted amount of time. If you run over, if it's only a minute, you know, if they gave you 15 minutes, you ran to 16, it probably wouldn't be a big deal. But if you were running 20, 25 minutes, I mean, they would have already pulled the plug on those participants.
Right. Nobody else can give their thing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's talk about one of our overlooked gems, the Louisiana cooking blog or cookbook, which is mostly made up of what I've done. I teach technical writing, and technical writing students have to learn how to format text. So you're taking a paragraph and making it into a list and putting in headings and have little dots out beside them called bullets, or sometimes your list has numbers. And so all of that shows up in recipes. And we have these great old books on our website, like the Creole Cookery Book. Come on. New Orleans Cookbook, New Orleans La Cuisine Creole. We have a lot of that stuff. And so over the last several years, I've been having my Tennessee students take an old recipe that's in the old format of just being a paragraph and put them in new modern recipe forms. And we've been making it available on our cooking blog. And we're up to, how many of these are there, 1,400?
Yeah, 1,400 recipes, which is pretty amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And again, and these are, like you said, a lot of these are these old legacy or, you know, historical type recipes. I've joined some of these groups like this online that do just general historic cookery. Some of them do colonial era cookery, so stuff from the 1600s, 1700s. But this is the Louisiana version of this, you know, going back to the, you know, the old French Spanish settlers, you know, those African American residents that were living here too. I mean, it's the collection's pretty amazing.
We should start maybe a Facebook group just for the cooking, Louisiana Anthology Cooking, and then post this stuff because it needs to get out there more. And this is one of the areas we want to try to expand. But here's a recipe for dry hack. Found in the New Orleans cookbook. Ingredients: 1 pound of steak, 4 potatoes, 1 onion, 2 tablespoons butter, salt, pepper, oil, or lard. Directions: 1, remove all fat and gristle from the steak. 2, finely chop the steak. 3, boil and mash the potatoes. 4, finely dice the onion. 5, fry the onions in butter. 6, mix steak, mashed potatoes, fried onions. Form small cakes with the mixture. 5, season cakes with salt and pepper. and 9, fry in oil or lard on cakes until cakes are a deep brown. That's kind of making me hungry. Here's another one, milk soup. Who knew there was such a thing? Ingredients, 4 cups of milk, 2 cups of water, 1 cinnamon stick, and today we could powder it, right? 1 lemon peel, 1 teaspoon of butter, 1 pinch of salt, 1 tablespoon of sago, starch. Directions: add milk, water, cinnamon, lemon peel, and butter to a pot. 2, bring it to a boil and then add salt and starch. 3, cook until clear. Interesting.
So you'll be heading into the kitchen to cook some of that later on.
Have a cooking this. Oh, here you go. Rice dressing with oysters. How about that?
Oh, wow.
So ingredients, 3 cups of rice, 1 large spoon of lard. Cooking with lard, Stephen.
Oh, boy.
1 small onion cut fine, 1 tablespoon pulverized sage, 1 teaspoon of salt, 1 teaspoon of pepper, 3 dozen oysters, goodness, 2 eggs, and 1 spoon of butter. Directions: put 3 cups of rice and 2 cups of water over a quick fire. That sounds like some dry rice there. Because usually it's 2 cups of water per 1 cup of rice. Let it come to a good boil, then cover slowly. Cook slow for 1/2 hour. Cook together in a pan the lard, onion, sage, salt, pepper, and oysters for 10 minutes. Turn the rice into a bowl. Beat 2 eggs and 1 spoon of butter into it well. Add the oysters and gravy, enough juice to make soft. Okay, there we go. This is enough to dress a medium-sized turkey. The oysters can be omitted if desired. Well, then it's not rice dressing with oysters. Yeah, so we've got 1,400s of these. Now, the way we work it, each student posts 4 recipes, 3 of them from these old cookbooks, and mostly not repeated, although sometimes, you know, a recipe will get repeated that I didn't pick up on that it had been done before. And then they pick one of their own personal recipes from now. So it's about 3/4 legacy recipes and 1/4 current recipes that people are, you know, using today. And it's all there, all 3, all the time, you know?
No, but I think what you said, I think it would be good if we started a new a new Facebook group.
I think so.
That would be its goal, to promote those recipes.
Louisiana Anthology Cooking, something like that, and then get people to join and post. Because every cooking blog or a cooking group on Facebook that I'm in, they don't want you posting stuff like this, you know, stuff from a website. Just type it in. Well, that doesn't do us any good to bring traffic to our...
This would, yeah.
I think we need to do it.
Well, and it's another thing you and I've been talking about is publicity. I mean, again, it draws attention to the cooking blog, but also to the broader project.
Well, and one big change that's coming. We're working with a friend, Debbie Hollis, who's been on the podcast before. She helps people get set up, and you know, like nonprofit organizations, stuff like that. So, and she's also going to help us with getting publicity out there, getting grants, things like that, because it's just been you and me for 10 years. But we want it to be ongoing. We have to bring in some other folks that'll keep it going after we're gone.
Yeah, yeah.
So keep an eye on this spot. We will give you updates as they become available. You know, right now we've just been working every week in the background trying to get a business plan together.
Which is not an easy process, as we've discovered.
Not something I would have ever done on my own.
No, it's outside our skill set, to use a cliche, but it really is. I mean,
I went to working for a university, so I would not have to write a business plan. So, my 2 grown sons are both entrepreneurs. Like, that seems to be the way the world is going these days. This is kind of an entrepreneurial endeavor, even though we haven't thought of it kind of as such. But
It's something we've done, you know, on our own for these last 10 years. But we do want it to be ongoing even after we're gone. We want some kind of structure in place to keep it going down the road. Because it would be
Hopefully this will do it, too.
Hope so.
And hopefully it will also, the real key, to get it, you know, to continue, would be to bring in other scholars after we're gone. You know,
right.
Somebody or somebody's plural that could take the thing over eventually.
Find somebody who's interested in the internet and Louisiana literature that can, keep the flame going. It's not that easy to find either.
And I'm thinking, especially, I think we made a kind of a smart move at the very beginning to put this all online because so much has migrated to the web, all kinds of information, you know, literature, history, politics, sports, just anything, sites for consumer goods, I mean, that kind of thing.
Right.
To go to the web, I think, was smart because at least right there, you're going to get traffic that a brick-and-mortar type outfit might not get.
Well, a book gets attention when it first comes out, and if it even stays in print, that attention kind of diminishes over time. But a website can keep growing and reaching new people in a way that a book could not.
Right. It's like its collection. The collection can keep growing, you know.
Right. We do want our book projects, you know, print book projects, but I think the core of it will always be online. Well, I see we're almost out of time. You and I actually have an appointment in a few minutes.
Yeah, we're, like I said earlier, we're going to have to move like lightning today to
right.
make that next appointment here in about 15 minutes or so.
But thank you for listening, and we'll be here every week. And also, thank you for coming on our website. We want all the viewers we can. It's nice to know that the stuff we're doing has a reach beyond us.
Yeah, if you do enjoy literature, and not just literature, but if you enjoy history, as we mentioned Wesley Harris pretty prominently a few minutes ago, you know, Wesley being a historian, that we brought on lots of historians on the show, we brought on biographers as well. So if you enjoy areas of writing other than just, you know, poetry, drama, and fiction, but if you enjoy history and biography and travel narratives, do please check us out because we've got literally something for everybody on the website.
Right.
The collection is so large, so vast, but it is so variegated in terms of just the types of texts that are on the site. I think that there would be something to appeal to a lot of different kinds of people who just like to, you know, read writings about Louisiana, because that is our, is and will remain our focus, is Louisiana.
We have a very narrow focus, which is also a very broad focus.
Yeah.
For the Louisiana Anthology Podcast, I'm Bruce McGee.
And I'm Steve Payne. Again, thanks to all of you for listening in this week. Please do tell your friends about us. We hope that you'll come back and join us for next week's edition of the Louisiana Anthology Podcast. Bye for now.